This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices, episode 203, was recorded on January 23rd, 2020. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode of Macro Voices is brought to you by TopTradersUnplugged.com, a podcast dedicated to quant and rules-based investing, helping investors overcome behavioral biases. Noted financial historian Russell Napier joins me as this week's feature interview guest. I particularly enjoyed this interview, and I think you will too. Russell says the U.S. is not at a risk of a new credit crisis in the immediate future, but myriad other economies around the globe, accounting for 46% of global GDP, are showing objective signs of near-term risk of a new credit crisis. If Russell's right, the next major global economic dislocation could be a credit contagion centered outside the United States, and the United States could become the benefactor of a flight to safety phenomenon. And that's just one of the many topics we discussed in this week's interview. Be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment after the feature interview, when we'll have one of Patrick's famous chart books, and we'll also discuss what it could mean for markets if the coronavirus epidemic were to escalate from here.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, let's talk the S&P 500. We're trading still decisively above 3,300, and this trend is pretty pronounced. What's your thinking here on the market?
Well, the coronavirus fears were definitely putting a damper on the melt-up, but as soon as we got today's WHO press conference where they said it's not time to panic yet, and to be clear, they said that doesn't mean we're not going to panic in the future, but they said it's not time yet to declare a global emergency. That seems to have led to another move up in stocks, and in fact, even before that press conference, I think in an anticipation that the situation was coming down, we saw what really looks to me like maybe the dip is over already. Now, it's important to remember, as everyone is so focused on the market implications of this, although there could be horrific humanitarian implications, it's very unlikely that we're going to have a long-term, lasting market implication. Of course, things could escalate dramatically to the point where it becomes, you know, bubonic plague or something. But anything short of that, if you look at the SARS epidemic in 2003, it had a lasting economic impact on Hong Kong, where it was centered. And there was certainly a great big panic in global markets. That great big panic blew over pretty quickly. Even though it killed 800 people, that still was not that big of a deal in terms of markets. So I don't think that there's any reason to expect the stock market to crash because of the coronavirus, unless there was just a really, really profound escalation where it turned into a global pandemic. Short of that, I think that potentially there's maybe some more downside as a result of this coronavirus thing. But everything that I see in this market, Patrick, is we've got a central bank largesse-driven melt-up. And I think that melt-up is likely to continue. Now, there's a lot of smart people out there that are calling tops for a variety of reasons. They could be right. But again, my core thesis is this melt-up is being driven by central bank largesse. And what's really going to change the direction ultimately is when central bank policy changes, probably for political reasons. Bottom line, I don't want to be in this market and have a lot of capital at risk because I do think it is being driven by artificial factors. But it seems to me like the opportunity may be to buy the dip and speculate on more upside using call options. Remember, calls are dirt cheap in terms of implied volatility here. So if you want to play the upside, the way to do it is with options. Now, Patrick, I know you've got plenty more to say on this yourself. Let's save that discussion for post-game because I want to go to your chart book and talk in some detail about the charts that you prepared.
All right, so let's move on to the dollar index, which in spite of a number of monetary policies from global central banks coming out this week, the dollar just keeps crawling a little bit higher. I mean, we're at least crawling towards 98 here on the upside. Do you think this is a new trend in the dollar?
Well, Patrick, today is the first day where it looks like we may see that upside breakout. What I've been saying for the last couple of weeks is, hey, as much as on a fundamental level, I'm still bullish. I think Jeff Snyder has the right story on where the dollar is headed. And by the way, Russell Napier is going to have quite a bit more to say for different reasons about why he sees a long-term dollar bullish case. Well, you know, as much as I thought that, if you look at the chart, we've had a series of lower highs and lower lows, and it looks like we had been beginning to establish a downsloping price channel. Now, we haven't yet broken that series of lower highs and lower lows, but it looks like we may be breaking through what would have been the upper channel resistance line on that formative price channel. The next step would be a daily close above 98. That would tell us that we actually have broken that pattern of lower highs and lower lows. So we're not quite there yet, but I think the dollar bulls have reason for some optimism here. I've said before we needed a daily close over 97 spot 50 on the March contract. We're looking at 97 spot 48, just a hair below it as we're speaking on Thursday afternoon. So we're not quite there, but we're right on the verge of it. Let's wait and see what next week brings. Now, Patrick, you've mentioned in several previous episodes that you've been particularly watching the dollar-euro currency cross as opposed to the dollar index with your members. What's going on there?
Right. So we've been watching that euro. And one of the things that I left the least level I was watching on the euro for the continuation higher would have been a euro that stayed above the 111 level. And with the ECB press conference and monetary policy statement coming out, this current breakdown in the euro down towards the one spot 1050 level where we were trading, it's the first sign of deterioration. So I have a chart that I want to share in the post game on that. But this is something we can't ignore. It really does look like this euro is beginning some sort of a downdraft. Anyway, let's move on to crude oil. What's your take on this big breakdown?
Well, it's exactly what I predicted in last week's show. Remember what I said is the major support levels are 58, 55, and 51. What I said last week is we already hit 58. We're due for a bounce. I said probably up to the 13-day moving average. We got just two ticks shy of it. And in fact, the way we got there was on a gap up open in reaction to the escalating tension in Libya. That only lasted a few seconds, and it was all downhill from there. And exactly as I predicted, I said 55 was the next support level. We got down to 54 spot 80, just about 20 cents below that, before beginning a bounce. And I think this bounce is probably going to have some legs. What we saw was the market really selling off after API inventory had forecast a really pretty gloomy picture. Once the EIA inventory was released today and it wasn't as bad as API had forecast, that seemed to get the bounce going. Then there was a little bit of a retrace because people said, wait, there's still something to panic over. What about this WHO press release? The press release from WHO came out and they said, look, it's not time to panic yet. It's not time to declare a global pandemic crisis. We don't have enough reason to escalate things to that level, at least not yet. That allowed crude oil to again recover and close close to the highs of the day. So it looks to me like the bounce that I predicted is already in process. And, you know, the question is, how high do we bounce from here? All the way back to 58? I kind of doubt it. I would say the 5-day moving average, which is currently at 57 spot 54, is the target. But that moving average, of course, will move down with the market over the next couple of days. So I think a bounce back up to the 5-day, we're probably going to get that. Do we get much more than that? It really depends on the news flow. What happens with the coronavirus situation? Goldman Sachs has a note out saying, you know, in the case of the SARS virus, that was good for at least $3 of downside in oil price because, of course, when you have a situation which could lead to a global slowdown in international travel, that obviously affects demand for jet fuel and so forth. So the coronavirus situation, it could potentially take us much lower in oil price, a re-escalation of either the Libyan or Iranian geopolitical situation could take us much higher in price. So I don't really have any strong conviction about what happens after this bounce, but I guess I would predict that the bounce is not quite over yet. We're at 55 spot 50 as we're recording on Thursday afternoon. I think we'll probably get up over the 200-day moving average, which is at 56 spot 83. That would be the minimum I would target. And if the 5-day moving average is still above that level, we'll probably get up to that too. But I don't know how much of a bounce we have. There is still another downside target at 50 spot 66, 5066. I think the news flow could easily take us back down to new lower lows in coming days. We'll see what happens.
So, Eric, how did the inventory numbers come in crude?
Well, Patrick, the numbers were a little bit bearish, but not nearly as bearish as API had set an expectation for. API, reporting the day before, thought that we were going to have builds across the board. The actual EIA numbers coming in a day delayed because of the holiday this morning at 11 a.m., 405,000 barrel drawdown on crude oil inventory. So a drawdown, but not a huge drawdown. Cushing, Oklahoma, drawing down 961,000 barrels. That warrants continued attention, as I've said before. I think we're still seeing reduced pressure from the Keystone Pipeline bearing on Cushing inventory, but it's interesting to me that the Cushing inventory drawdown was even bigger than the national drawdown. Gasoline building 1.7 million barrels, but distillates drawing down 1.2 million barrels. So if you've got a build of 1.7, a drawdown of 1.2 in distillates, and a drawdown of 405,000 barrels on crude oil, that works out to about flat in terms of net petroleum and finished product inventory change. U.S. production holding steady at 13 million barrels. That's unchanged from last week. It was a new record when it was set last week. Imports 6.4 million barrels, exports 3.4 million barrels. Tape action was a bounce. We were already oversold in reaction to API and coronavirus fears. We got the EIA report, not as bad as API, and then the WHO press conference where they said it's not time to panic yet. Those two things helped to set a bounce in motion, and I suspect that bounce still has farther to go to the upside.
All right, well, let's move on to gold, which has done a pretty good job consolidating decisively above the 1500 level. I mean, we're 1563 right now. What's your thinking about gold? Are we going to break out for another leg higher?
Well, Patrick, last week I said it looked like maybe we were seeing the beginnings of a formative bull flag formation. The flag formation never actually came to pass. It looked like we just continued to move a little bit higher. And I'd say at this point, it's a sideways consolidation, not a whole lot to read into what the tape is telling us. What I would say is we're finally above the top of that gap that existed in the tape a couple of weeks ago. So we had the gap, we had the blow off top, we went down and traded below the gap level. Now we're finally back up above the gap level. The next big test would be getting back up above that high at 1600 and really getting some serious upside here. I would say that the market has continued to surprise me with more strength than I expected at every turn. And I don't mind admitting to our listeners that I was wrong when I was skeptical about the gold market earlier this year. But still, folks, a healthy bull market is one that has its share of pullbacks. When things go up in a straight line, it's often a setup for a big disappointment later. So right now, it really looks like this chart's looking pretty bullish. We need to see a breakout from this consolidation and a move higher above those previous highs at 1600. But keep in mind that if there were a catalyst, and I don't see one right now, but let's say hypothetically that the Fed surprised us with a hawkish change in policy. If you had a catalyst like that and things got going to the downside, if you look at the COT positioning, there could be a lot of downside in gold in a correction. The best thing, as far as I'm concerned, that gold bulls like myself could wish for here would be a serious deep correction down to 1377 or so, the top of the breakout zone. That would clean out the system, clean up the chart, and really set the stage for a healthy move higher. Right now, I'm still have a few concerns, but it looks like the resolution so far is going to be to the upside. But Patrick, before you even ask me about the 10-year, I'm going to turn it around and ask you, because frankly, I don't have a whole lot new to add this week. What are you seeing in terms of 10-year treasury yields?
Well, you know, overall, after that September bottom in yields down below the one spot 50 level, the reflation trade has really been the storyline for the last kind of 4 or 5 months. And so far, the rally higher in yields has actually been very benign. After that November into December consolidation, we should have easily seen, from a technical perspective, an advance in yields back to the 2 to 2.25 range on the upside. And so far, not only have we not been able to surpass the 2% yield level, but we're rolling right over to a critical level at around the one spot 70 level where the lows came in November and December. I mean, this would be a big blow to the bond bears if we saw the 170 level give out. I mean, that's got to be the thing to watch into next week for sure. But anyway, Eric, I have a chart on this, so I'm going to look forward to talking about it in the post game. So let's move on. This week's featured interview guest is Russell Napier. So Eric, why did we invite Russell back on the show this week?
Russell is one of my all-time favorite guests. In fact, one of the inspirations for creating Macro Voices is I was listening to a Russell Napier interview on another podcast. And Russell is a very heavyweight guy. He was famous back when he was at CLSA as a macro heavyweight. And the podcast host kept trying to direct him to dumb his commentary down to more of a retail level. And I thought to myself, I want to create a podcast where somebody like Russell Napier can just tell his story and not have someone try to translate it for him and dumb it down into retail speak. So he's one of my favorite, all-time favorite guests. And he's also a financial historian with a profound perspective on just so many things in markets. He's not another one of these talking head guys who can just spin a good story. He really, really knows his stuff. I know that you had the honor of attending his financial history class, which he teaches from time to time, and had a chance to hang out and have a few beers with him. So I'm envious of that opportunity. I want to take this opportunity to apologize to our listeners. We had a conundrum that Russell was in a remote location and the phone system went down. We had to fail back to Russell's cell phone for this interview. He really went the extra mile for us. He was willing to actually sit on a windowsill and hang his body partially out the window, trying to get the best possible signal. We had the choice of settling for that or having to cancel the interview at the last minute and go with a backup. And he's such a terrific guest. I didn't want to miss it. So we really appreciate Russell working with us to try to make the best of this that we possibly could, and we'll ask you to excuse any minor anomalies that may still exist in the audio. This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by TopTradersUnplugged.com. In the past, the founder and host, Niels Kastrup Larsen, has provided Macro Voices listeners with some really good resources. But I think you'll agree with me that this time, he's really outdone himself with a brand new third edition to his Ultimate Guide to Systematic Trading Books. Now, this latest edition isn't limited to just quant trading books. It's actually a comprehensive guide to many of the best investing books ever written. And right now, Macro Voices listeners can get a free copy of this excellent guide to all the best investing books by going to toptradersunplugged.com/macro guide. And if you haven't heard it yet, be sure to listen to my full-length interview with Niels Kastrup Larsen on trend following. The download link is in your research roundup email. Check out toptradersunplugged.com today. You'll be glad you did.
Eric's interview with Russell Napier is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Russell Napier, who, of course, is the founder of Eric. Not my name, Eric with a K, but Eric with a C, an acronym for the Electronic Research Interchange. And, of course, it is a very prominent website for the sale of institutional research to institutional investors. Russell, it's great to have you back on the program. You know, I have, ever since the 2008 financial crisis, I've predicted that eventually this response of encouraging even more borrowing would eventually set us up for another credit crisis in the United States. Well, so far, I'm either very, very early or very, very wrong. And of course, in this business, very early equals very wrong. Is there objective reason, I know that you are much more deeply in touch with the data than I am, to expect another credit crisis either in the United States or elsewhere in the world?
Well, there is an objective analysis. It may surprise your listeners to know what it is, because it doesn't relate to the absolute level of debt, even the absolute level of debt relative to GDP. For instance, Japan has now reached a debt-to-GDP level of 375% without a credit crisis. So it suggests that the levels of debt, the thing that keeps you and I awake every night, may of itself not provide that much information on timing. What has provided information on timing is the growth rate of the debt of GDP relative to trend. So I'm sure your listeners will know the difference, because you could actually have quite a low level of total debt to GDP and still have a very high growth rate in debt to GDP relative to its trend level. And when the growth is more than 9% above trend, there is a 50-50 chance of a systemic banking crisis within 3 years. One other objective measurement is a debt service ratio for the economy as a whole, aggregate data, and that relates only to the private sector, not the public sector. And that looks once again at how far the current debt service ratio is above trend. And both of these indicators are put together by the Bank for International Settlements with new data that they created after the great financial crisis, because we didn't really have very good data on private sector debt before the crisis. So to cut to the bottom line, Eric, using these two measures, we conclude America does not, within the next 3 years, face a systemic banking crisis. There are high levels of debt, particularly in the corporate sector. Corporate debt to GDP has reached a new all-time high, above 2007, but not much above 2007. Offsetting that, the private sector has degeared pretty significantly. The thing that seems to insulate America somewhat from this is not just that the aggregate growth in debt is not that great because of a degearing in the private sector, but because so much of this debt post-2010 is not held by the banking sector at all. Growth in bank assets has been really rather subdued post-2008, 2009, but it's really the growth in the bond markets. And a credit crisis would really be where the inability or unwillingness to repay debt wipes out equity in the banks. That's what we traditionally think of a credit crisis. Whereas if we get defaults in the corporate bond sector, it clearly has an impact, but it has an impact on pensioners, on life insurance funds, to some extent on mutual funds that happen to own fixed interest securities. And these institutions on the whole, bit of a generalization, are not geared. So the theory of this was always that by spreading the credit risk more widely over stronger pools of capital in a geared banking system, that when credit defaults come, as they inevitably do, the impact is not a crisis. This cannot be said for most markets outside of America, where most of the credit risk still rests on bank balance sheets. And just to cut back to the key indicator, if we just go on the growth rate of current growth rate and debt to GDP relative to trend, 43% of the world's economic system is flashing up red for danger, but America is most clearly not on that list. So we can maybe talk about what that 43% of global GDP is. Of course, if I say to you that I have an objective indicator which gives you a 50-50 shot of a systemic banking crisis within 3 years, it obviously leaves open the prospect that it can be wrong, but those are the best objective indicators we have, and on those, it should not happen in the United States.
Okay, so to summarize and make sure I've got this right, you're saying that because the risk in the United States really falls on real money, people who are not using a lot of leverage, perhaps the U.S. does not face any imminent risk, but you're saying there is a very large imminent risk elsewhere in the world. So where else in the world, which countries, which economies, and what would be the potential risks and also the knock-on effects? Is there a contagion risk that spreads into a global credit situation?
Okay, we are looking at two separate indicators here, and we'll class them as red for danger and amber for warning. So which countries in the world have two reds for danger on both these measures? And remember, there's a very specific definition here, a systemic banking crisis within 3 years. So actually, Eric, that's quite a bit bigger than your standard credit risk. It's something on a bigger scale than that, because not all credit crises turn into banking crises. So here are the four countries that we have two reds for danger: Hong Kong, Canada, China, and Turkey. Turkey, I think, is already in significant default. That's being politicized through pressure on its domestic banking system to keep lending money anyway, but it's already there. Now, the others are important, particularly China, obviously, because it is such a huge proportion of world GDP and a huge proportion of marginal growth rates. But this is not a new story for China. It's been going on for several years. In many ways, it's already bucked the trend by being able to continue it. But to put it into context, in the first quarter of last year, this data comes with a significant lag, but in the first quarter of last year, China's debt to GDP ratio grew by 5% in 3 months. So it's a country which is not producing a great growth in money, but it's producing a great growth in credit. I'm sure many of your listeners are in Canada. Canada is on this list, and Hong Kong is on this list. These are important countries, but not as important as China. Countries with one red is a much longer list. So remember, these are not contingent. It's not necessarily true that because you're flashing red on the two indicators that you've got a greater possibility of a credit crisis than because you have one red indicator on the objective measure. So one reds are Japan, the Netherlands, Singapore, Chile, Thailand, Colombia, Saudi Arabia, and Indonesia. Now, several emerging markets in there, but several that are not emerging markets, Japan, the Netherlands, and Singapore are all on that list, and Saudi Arabia hardly counts as an emerging market either. Crucially, the Netherlands is inside the Eurozone. I just wanted to mention a few of those that are on amber. And the amber ones actually are not that different in terms of what they're telling us. It's almost a 50% chance of a systemic banking crisis within 3 years. But in that list, we have France, Belgium, and Finland. So we now have four countries inside the Eurozone that are likely to have a systemic banking crisis. And this is really, really important. Your listeners will know what happened in 2007, 2009. They will know the extreme reactions of the policymakers in the US, particularly the central bank, to that crisis. But this is a very different problem for Europe, where we have 19 countries in the Eurozone, four of them likely to have a systemic banking crisis, but just one level of interest rates to be delivered to all of them. As you know, that interest rate is currently close to zero. We're below zero. Where do we go in monetary policy is one of the bigger questions we're asking for all the countries in the world, but it's a particularly big question to ask for Europe. If the next economic downturn does threaten systemic banking crises in four of those countries, but not in the other 15, and crucially, France is one of them. So this really is the huge chasm at the center of the Eurozone. So when we look at this data for aggregate debt, likely credit crisis, I think the biggest thing it throws up is a huge risk in mainland Europe. All of that together, to me, Eric, suggests a strong dollar, that the risk of a slowdown becoming a credit crisis does create extreme monetary policy. And if America is not to be in that camp, is not to be having to follow a similar policy, maybe a looser monetary policy, but not the extreme monetary policy associated with saving banking systems from collapse, then that is likely to be a strong dollar, particularly when we're talking about 43% of the global economy likely to be facing problems of this magnitude. So a strong dollar, but particular problems for the Europeans, because France and Germany are at the core of this entire project of creating a single currency. One of them has a debt-to-GDP ratio of 329%. The other has a debt-to-GDP ratio of 181%, and they both have the same interest rate. And I think that is leading us to a very dangerous place for Europe.
Russell, as you were speaking, the wheels were spinning in my mind. It seems if what you're saying is we don't have this systemic banking and credit crisis risk in the United States, at least not on the immediate horizon, but the list of places where we do see that risk, we're not talking about Zimbabwe and little countries. We're talking about major economies like Europe and Canada and China. I mean, in Hong Kong, these are really big, systemically important economies. That, to me, just spells what has to be a major capital flow expectation. You already mentioned one aspect of it, which is a strengthening dollar in this outlook. But I would think there's also a flight to safety trade into U.S. treasuries. And depending on the mandates of the institutions that we're talking about, potentially also into U.S. corporate credit, if corporate credit is what's failing elsewhere around the world. So what would you see in terms of what we should expect around international capital flows? And does it at some point result in European regulators and other regulators putting in some kind of capital controls to prevent that flight to safety?
Yeah, well, I tend to agree with that, that capital will be leaving these jurisdictions. First, because of the risk to credit, and we've already seen this already, that risk to credit, to the extent that it also threatens banking systems, takes things on to a completely different level. To watch corporate credit melt down is to lose money in corporate credit. To watch a meltdown in corporate credit, which threatens bank stability, threatens deposits, so we're on an entirely different level of risk once a normal credit deterioration infects the banking system. Because the last one infected the banking system, we've come to believe they all infect the banking system. That's not actually true. Quite often you have a credit deterioration without threatening deposits. But this data suggests that the banking system itself would be threatened. Crucially, in Europe, we have a thing called the Bank Resolution and Recovery Directive, which, if implemented, would see depositors in banks in Europe take a loss. Now, those depositors would have to have a deposit in excess of 100,000 euros, or 100,000 euros is guaranteed by the government, but depositors in excess of that could face, or should face under the law, a significant capital loss once other parts of the capital structure have been burned through. So I'm talking about that to show you why we might indeed get capital flight with very little deterioration at all because of that new change in legislation in Europe, which clearly did not operate the last time we had a banking crisis in Europe. All depositors, almost without exception, certainly in the 2008-2009 episode, were made good. So that could target capital outflow. I have written for over a year now that this outlook for American equities is therefore reasonably positive if this economic malaise does not infect U.S. economic growth. That's, I'm sure many of your listeners will realize, quite a big if. But the more this is something outside of America, not in it, it brings lower inflation to America. It brings lower treasury yields to America. First impact, because it's bringing lower inflation. Second impact, for the one you mentioned, that capital flow could be coming to treasuries as a safe haven asset. And a lower discount rate for future cash flows usually means a higher valuation. And I think we've been watching that actually for the last 12-15 months as global growth has slowed, but US growth has not been yet too badly hit. And finally, and most importantly, the point you raise is what would European policymakers in particular do about this? A move to helicopter money, which I'll leave there because I think we might want to discuss that in more detail, seems more and more likely given Christine Lagarde is at the European Central Bank. But you mentioned capital controls, and of course we get to a stage where that becomes a real possibility. It is noticeable that the euro has been falling pretty consistently for a long time with a current account surplus. And if you have a country with a large, or in this case a currency zone with a large current account surplus and its exchange rate is falling, that suggests we already have significant capital flight. And my conversations with high net worth individuals in Europe is that they do fear something from the government that will be bad for their wealth. Whether they're as explicit as fearing capital controls, I couldn't possibly say. But they fear some sort of policy reaction next time that will be extremely bad for savers. So I would argue that there's a shift of savings already underway out of Europe, which is beneficial for the United States and has been beneficial for United States assets. But in the next recession, when it comes, should it come, the structural issues in Europe are so great, the responses from the government would have to be so great that indeed accelerated capital flight is really something that's coming. And it may sound that I'm being unduly patriotic here, but I think a large portion of it would also come to the United Kingdom, which now has a stable centre-right government, which should be in place for 5 years. So the United Kingdom economy is not a beneficiary of problems in Europe. We're much too closely tied to Europe for that. No one in this country should wish any ill on the European economy. It's bad for all of us. But capital flight is a different issue given the stability, the political stability in this country compared to the coalition building which is necessary across Europe at a time when all of these things are forcing European politics towards the extreme left and the extreme right. So that capital flight, or these problems developing in Europe, are going to affect capital flight from so many, many angles. And I wouldn't rule out political instability as being a key thing in Europe that sends capital fleeing for safety.
Now, Russell, the expectations that you've described around a credit and potentially credit and banking crisis all sound very deflationary to me. But you were reading my mind when you brought up helicopter money. If we get an introduction of helicopter money, which I think is very likely at some point during this process, a lot of people have opined that that's going to be what tips us from deflation into inflation, will be the appearance of helicopter money, which is pumping money into the real economy as opposed to asset markets. So how does that all net out in terms of inflation versus deflation in terms of what's coming?
you know, I'm just writing or putting together now my last 25 years of work writing for institutional investors. I note that my first reference to deflation comes in 1998 after the Asian economic crisis, when Asia was exporting deflation around the world. And really in every business cycle since then, at the bottom of that business cycle, we have had to either write about or contemplate deflation or actually experienced it. And we have experienced it three times in America since 1998, albeit sometimes a fairly marginal deflation. But it was something that was supposed to be institutionally impossible. And I was told by any number of academics that it could never happen because of fiat money, but it happened. It happened anyway. All of that's going to the point to say, Eric, that I think I will change my mind if we get the helicopter money. That to constantly write about the risk of deflation in cyclical downturns, given the structural overlay of deflation for 25 years, has been one thing. But when politicians and central bankers, because remember, both have to act in concert to construct this policy, when they resort to helicopter money, I think I won't, however long my career may last from here, will not be writing about deflation again. I think this is the last time. So I think it's important. I think it's potent. I think it's a drug. In other words, it's very hard to stop. And I think it's debilitating in the long run. And if you have something that's, you know, potent, addictive, and debilitating, I think it changes the next 20 to 30 years. So I would agree that when it does come, it's going to have a very profound impact. Second point, we get the disease first and then we get the cure. So it may be possible for central banks and governments to collude in this policy without a shock, but it's much more likely that it's a shock that brings them to this extreme policy, an extreme policy which really has no history of success. The success it has been temporary. It's ended up with addiction and pretty destructive outcomes. But we need quite a shock before people are prepared to take that risk. And most importantly, I think, and something for maybe a longer discussion, is it also brings financial repression. And I want your listeners to think of what happens the day that modern monetary theory is announced in Europe. What happens to long-term bond yields, which are currently close to zero? I would argue that they would jump by 150 to 200 basis points very, very quickly indeed. Institutional investors know the addictive nature of this policy. They know the long-run outlook for this policy. If you're holding 10, 15, 20-year government debt, you really want to get out as soon as possible. Those jumps in long-term bond yields in some way offset the positive move you've had by infusing money into the real economy at the short end. They'd have to be stopped. And I don't think you'll find anybody in the MMT camp who could foresee allowing interest rates to be set by the market, long-term rates to be set by the market, as they get onto the business of printing money and putting money into the real economy. So the outlook for America, assuming America has not had to resort to the same policy, which is the underlying basis for this discussion we're having at the minute, and they get there eventually, but certainly not as quickly as Europe. I think most savers in Europe, whether they're institutions or whether they are private sector citizens, will be scrambling to get their savings out of the system. It may be good for growth, maybe in the short run. It may be good for equity markets in the short run. I don't doubt that. But fixed interest investors, I think, will be rushing for the exits. And that is where perhaps maybe only those capital controls can allow the state, allow the central bankers to manipulate those long-term interest rates as they provide that dose of morphine, which is supposed to be reinvigorate the patient, but as most of us know, really numbs the patient.
Russell, I'm numbing my brain listening to this, because what I fear is a lot of what you're saying is really that really big, important things are going to change based on policy, based on government action that is very hard to predict in terms of its timing. Because the argument that you just made a moment ago, which is you want to be the heck out of duration risk when MMT hits the stage, makes perfect sense. I get it. But just a few minutes ago, when you were talking about how there's very likely to see this credit crisis and potentially banking crisis elsewhere in the world, but not in the United States right away, that sounded like an incredibly bullish argument for U.S. duration risk. And it sounds to me like it is a very bullish argument for duration risk until the day they change the rules, at which point you want to get the hell out as soon as you possibly can. And it's impossible to predict when that day is coming because it's political. Am I missing anything there?
No, I agree with that. And just for the record, I've been pretty bullish on U.S. long-term government bonds for the past several years on the basis that they wouldn't change the rules, that they would continue with the old rules, that we would have a disinflation rather than reflation. And I continue to hold that view. But back to the point of a few minutes ago, this is really going to change things. Now, if I can write for 25 years about the risk of deflation and then tell you that I'll probably never have to write that again, then I'm clearly talking about a long-term structural bear market in duration in fixed interest securities. And anybody who's looked at the charts of very long-term interest rates knows that these are 30 to 40-year bear markets. This policy will begin, whether it comes from Europe initially or whether it comes through China printing more money with a flexible exchange rate. It will kickstart something, I think, that will push a bear market in these instruments for a long time. Personally, I own 30-year treasuries. I believe that there's a final deflationary shock coming, as I say, mainly coming from outside the United States of America, from the two sources I've mentioned, either Europe or China, and that will be very bullish. But this is much more dangerous than previous purchases of fixed interest securities in America, because this is somewhere towards the end of a very, very long bull market. I think it's a 40-year bull market now. We're getting very close to the last year, year and a half, who knows, 6 months of this bull market. There may be very significant gains to be made in that last period. But you're absolutely right, Eric. When they change the rules of the game, we have to think twice about playing the same game as we've played before. And I think the whole point in changing the rules of the game is to inflate away debt. There's been no doubt why the rules are changing. MMT proponents might tell you it's a need to create more money, or it's a need to move wealth and inequality of wealth. No, it's a need to inflate away debt. And you do not want to be owning debt when those changes in the rules come. So it's probably a more dangerous asset class to hold in the past, because we're in the dying days of the bull market, but there still could be a significant final rally before the institutional framework ends and we begin to inflate away those debts. As is absolutely essential, is the most likely way for any democracy to proceed. I think it's highly predictable, has been for a long time, as many people know, but we just don't know when. So final call is there is one last push for this bull market, but it is that we are living in many more, much more dangerous times if you're a fixed interest investor.
Okay, so the call for now is long U.S. duration risk, but pay close attention and be ready for the rules to change. Let's talk a little bit more about the rules changing, how the rules might change, and what the other implications of the rules changing would be. I think you and I agree that helicopter money is coming in some form at some time, perhaps first in Europe. I want to talk about what are the other ramifications and implications for the investment world. One of my predictions here has been, I think it's going to be perceived as fantastically successful at first, because all of the negative implications of helicopter money, they take a while to kick in. So I think that there's going to be a huge victory celebration, and the negative aspects are going to be delayed by a couple of years until it's probably too late. Am I on the right track? And how do you think about planning ahead for this changing of the rules that's coming in the macro landscape in the next few years as helicopter money is introduced?
Well, I've never personally experimented with morphine and heroin, but what you've described to me there, Eric, I think is the kind of, if we are talking in medicine terms, I think morphine has kind of the same effect on patients you've just described for an economy. I'm on record as saying I think the European bank share prices could double within weeks after a move to modern monetary theory. It's basically, when you start to inflate away debts, you're taking a lot of the risk away of bankruptcy. And these bank share prices are priced for bankruptcy. Now, you might say, well, if you produce 10% inflation, you'll produce 15% interest rates. But the whole point about the financial repression that comes with modern monetary theory is you don't. And you're letting people escape from the price they should be paying for borrowing too much money. So I think you're right. In the very short run, you get a hell of a run-up in equity prices, particularly bank share prices. However, and this is the key, however, we have history with financial repression. We've had it before. This move by the government to inflict the wrong cost of money, not just at the short end, but the medium term and the long end as well. And what it does produce is, over the long term, really, really bad asset allocation. And that period that we had it in the past lasted from the end of World War II right up until the early 1980s, and in some places in Europe into the early 1990s. The United Kingdom itself went bankrupt, or certainly had to go to the IMF for support in the late 1970s because of these policies. There's a myriad of them. I've got a 90-minute presentation on all of those policies, Eric, but I think they all come and all stem from a move to modern monetary theory. It's what the modern monetary theory helicopter people don't like to talk about, which is the other side of their policy, which is effectively destroying market prices for important market prices to savers that direct investment. But you're absolutely right. This takes longer to unfold. And for those institutions that are having their debts relieved, then the share prices should probably go up in the short run, not down.
Russell, I've got to believe our listeners' heads are already spinning, and I hate to do this, but we've got to make them spin a little harder. Let's expand this conversation now to incorporate negative interest rates. 7 or 8 years ago, if you were, you know, attending a professional finance conference and you started talking about negative interest rates, you would have been laughed out of the room as an amateur who just doesn't understand economics, because that's impossible. We've somehow, in less than a decade, gotten to the point where it seems like nobody even questions the reasonableness of negative interest rates, paying a fee for the privilege of lending money to someone. How does this all unfold, and what do you expect? And I shouldn't probably assume. I think negative interest rates are going to be part of this equation that you're already describing. Maybe I shouldn't assume that. So let's start with, is negative interest rates a part of the story? And if so, what does it mean? How do we plan for it? How should we think about it?
Okay, to alleviate that, you basically need nominal GDP growth higher than interest rates, or you need inflation higher than interest rates. So the reason we've ended up with negative nominal rates is they just failed to generate the inflation. So I would argue to you, Eric, that if they did manage to generate inflation, let's pick Europe, of 4 to 5%, interest rates would not be negative. They would be somewhat higher. They're probably quite happy to permit that. However, from our last answer to your last question, there is no way they're going to allow them to rise close to inflation or above inflation. So I don't think necessarily that financial repression means negative nominal rates. Obviously, you get there quicker if you're inflating away debt, so you can keep rates negative in nominal terms. But there's no reason why they shouldn't go up a little bit, as long as they remain significantly below inflation. They are with us at the moment. They've been alleviated a little bit in the last 2 months, but they're still with us. At the minute, they're destroying the financial system. We have a financial system we know today was really invented in the 19th century in terms of commercial banking anyway, but also in terms of insurance and other things. They all developed rapidly in the 18th century, and they've never had to cope with interest rates like this. So they're part of the problem that might take us to modern monetary theory, because they're simply destroying the stability. We always think of banks, but I think more importantly, we should think of life insurance companies, particularly in Northern Europe, that guarantee certain yields to investors, which have been impossible to attain in any reasonably risk-free way for a long period of time, but also pension funds in Northern Europe, where we simply don't have the level of reinvestment returns that are anywhere near likely to be able to satisfy the obligations to pensioners going forward. So I look at negative nominal rates as already creating a crisis, already, if you like, leading us up to modern monetary theory. Modern monetary theory coming along because these negative rates have done so much damage to the financial system. But I do see that interest rates will be allowed to go up somewhat. Certainly market forces will try to push them up dramatically if we move to MMT. I don't think the authorities will need to keep them negative if they generate this inflation. I think they'll succeed in generating inflation. So there'll be a little bit of positive yield on these instruments. However, and this is the crucial thing, the key damage to investors in the long bond market is not the nominal losses on the bond. It is the real losses on the bond. That is where you're going to lose your money. So we may not look at huge negative nominal returns from bonds over 20, 30 years. It'll be losses in real terms. So if that's the mix between nominal and real losses in bonds over the long term, it could come with slightly higher interest rates, but ultimately interest rates that are never allowed to approach a level that is close to or higher than the rate of inflation.
Okay, if your prediction is interest rates stay way below the inflation rate, put another way, that's a negative real yield. That just immediately brings gold to my mind, because gold generally thrives on negative real yields. Tell us about how gold fits into the story.
Yeah, absolutely. That is, gold is a strange beast, because we don't really have market prices for it for a long time, because gold was money and money was gold, so the price of the two didn't diverge. But when we do have the gold price decoupled from big money, the level of real interest rates has been a key driver for the gold price. And the deeper the negative real rates, the more likely it is that the gold price goes up. So that's the first forecast. The second forecast, obviously, is what we just discussed there, is really how governments back away from markets. How governments decide that market prices are delivering their own results and want to suspend them, and particularly long-term interest rates. Now, in a world where the government gets into that business, suspending market prices, we have a threat to liberty. There is less liberty in a country where the government dictates where your savings should go to. Now, that might be just liberty of the free movement of capital, or it may be deeper forms of liberty than that. But that is where the gold price gets a second kick. It is not an asset which is easy to manipulate for governments. I know in 1933, I think it was, Roosevelt passed his famous diktat on the confiscation of gold. But ultimately, gold was a significant asset class in those days held by individuals. That is not where we are today. Today, most of the wealth of the world is held by institutions. It is not held in the form of gold. And institutions are very, very easily manipulated because they are regulated. You don't need to own a financial institution if you can regulate it. So gold is this little asset class which the state may eventually come after, but really poses no threat to its ability to sequester covertly or overtly people's savings if they are they have their savings in regulated financial institutions. So eventually the state may come after those who own gold, but for a long period of time, gold will be an asset class which is really of little interest to them because there's so much plucking of rich feathers from the regulated financial institution. So it's very much a bull market in gold. It's probably lasts as long as the bear market in bonds, which I think is probably 30 years. How long will it take to reduce our debt to GDP ratios to a reasonable level? Well, that depends on the gap between inflation and interest rates. But 30 years doesn't seem an unreasonable period, unless, of course, we go for dramatic moves in inflation, such as France did after World War II, 60-70%, where they're able to halve their debt to GDP ratio in just a few years. That, I think, is in the modern era far too socially dislocative to be contemplated, assuming they have that level of control. So I think more like a 30-year period of inflation, 3-4% above interest rates is more likely. So that's a very prolonged bull market in gold.
Russell, would I be correct to interpret what you just said, if I put it another way, as the only way out of this debt situation is to inflate away the real value of that debt? That process might take 20 or 30 years to play out because there's so much debt. And during that process, gold is the obvious place to be. That's the speculative bet to make if you expect and want to be rewarded for correctly anticipating that it will take decades to unwind the overhang of debt that we have by inflating it away. Is that the gist of it?
That is the gist of it. And of course, they don't always have control. This is the history of inflation, one which modern monetary theorists are keen to ignore. But it is that we just provide the right level of inflation, everybody's happy and nothing changes. Behavior changes, and velocity in particular changes. So at any given point in time, the attempt by central bankers and governments combined to keep inflation just a couple of percentage points ahead of interest rates can easily get out of control. Inflation can easily break out as velocity goes up, as unionization probably comes back quite rightly to defend workers from the impact of inflation. There's so many things that they simply don't control, even though they think they can control everything. So gold is a particularly good cover in these surprising bursts of inflation that might come along as well. It is worth just reminding ourselves that there are quicker ways to get rid of your debt burden, which is excessively high levels of inflation. Whereas I don't think any developed world country will go for that. You never know. You can never be too sure that there wouldn't be a political party somewhere. We're looking at extreme left and extreme right making greater grounds across the world that they wouldn't go for the short shock to get rid of these debt burdens very quickly. And that would mean levels of inflation which are 20, 30, 40%. So that's not a key forecast. But we have to remember there is a risk for some states that the institutional fabric of the states begins to crumble. And as it begins to crumble, resort to the printing press as a solution. Never been a good solution, but many people, whether they're in Venezuela or Zimbabwe or Argentina, have resorted to it in the past. There are many people who may resort to that short-term solution, which could take inflation well above that level, in which case destroying debt burdens happens really quite quickly indeed. But my forecast is that the developed world nations on the whole will avoid that rush to short-term destruction of debt values in purchasing power terms and try to do it slowly. Financial repression is a phrase that some of your listeners will have heard of. I was once asked by a retired lady how I would put that phrase into English, which is a very good question, I think. And I replied that it was stealing money from old people slowly. And the slowly bit is important because you don't want to frighten the horses. You want to try and keep them corralled and fixed interest security. So on the whole, doing it slowly is probably the democratic way to do it.
Russell, I am in complete agreement with you that it is profoundly unlikely that developed major economies would consciously and intentionally resort to extremely high inflation. I don't think anybody is going to think that's the right solution and implement it intentionally. But I want to come back to what you said about how easily inflation can start to run away. And while Paul Volcker was still alive, he said what he did in the 80s could not be done today because you can't solve a runaway inflation problem by dramatically increasing interest rates when you have the amount of debt that we have today, because it would just cripple the entire global economy, starting with the U.S. government, which would be unable to roll its debt burden. So how would they fight? As you say, it's very easy for inflation to start to get away from you. What do they do in order to combat that?
Well, Mr. Volcker wasn't wrong in very many things. In fact, I'm sure your listeners could send in some things he was wrong in, but I personally can't think of very many at all. So he was certainly right about that. When Volcker took over, it's a remarkable story that isn't told in this whole story of that great change, is that America's debt-to-GDP ratio, certainly its government debt-to-GDP ratio, but even its aggregate, was reaching very low levels. Now, that wasn't a sign of great success. In fact, it was a sign that the previous theft of savings from fixed income investors had worked, that the very high level of inflation during the 70s in America and the United Kingdom actually brought Reagan and Thatcher to power at a time when government debt to GDP was incredibly low levels. So the Volcker pain, and it was incredibly painful for the private sector, would be just on an entirely different level today, because it's not just that we have much higher government debt to GDP, it's there in the private sector as well. So what on earth could they do if inflation begins to get out of control? Because they're simply not prepared to use interest rates. Well, we have a great historical incident of that, which is what happened before Volcker. And what happened before Volcker, before Miller, but during Arthur Burns, is that the Republican president of the United States of America introduced price controls and credit controls. Those were also backed by the Democrats, and Jimmy Carter, when he came along, was also into trying to persuade people not to borrow money. You've got to remember that if you keep inflation above interest rates, we're all going to borrow money. We're all massively incentivized to borrow money. So this is the problem with modern monetary theory and creating a little bit of inflation. It inevitably takes you into more controls and less markets. And the ones I've just mentioned there, I think, are the key ones, price controls and credit controls, and attempting to keep bank credit growth quite low, even though we all want to borrow. And through keeping bank credit growth low, keeping money supply rule. The Office of Price Commission, established by Richard Nixon, was set up and run by a man called Donald Rumsfeld. Donald Rumsfeld was quite busy. You can imagine how many companies were asking for price rises. So he hired someone to help him called Dick Cheney. So for those of us who believe that certain parties, Republican or Democrat, have ideological limits and restrictions as to the things they will do, I think the whole concept that Richard Nixon appointed Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney to be the price czars, the price commissioners, shows you that when things get tough, when the going gets tough, the tough get going, and anything is possible. So the bottom line in that is less market and more control. And I don't think it really matters whether it's Elizabeth Warren or Donald Trump, who happens to be in the White House at the time. We've already seen that in extreme situations, a Republican president, such as George Bush Jr., was quite capable of effectively nationalizing the banking system. So the short answer to your question, Eric, is less pricing and more control if inflation gets out of control, but not that great jump in nominal rates, which is the tough, tough medicine that Volcker could inflict, but which I think we just could not deal with in the modern economy.
Russell, I could go on for another hour talking to you about all of the different nuances and implications of the issues we're talking about for the U.S. economy. But I want to use the time that we have remaining to shift gears now and talk about another subject that you wrote about in the Solid Ground Quarterly Report, which for the benefit of our institutional audience is just a terrific piece of research that's offered through the ERIC website. You talked about China basically trying to avoid getting into a Cold War with the United States. But if I've interpreted you correctly, you think that it is inevitable that we eventually fall into a U.S.-China Cold War. That is, needless to say, a huge both geopolitical and economic prediction. Did I get it right, first of all? And beyond that, please give us a summary of what your thinking is, what people should expect, and what it means both for the world and for investors.
Yeah, we are in the foothills of a Cold War. I think those actually are the words of Henry Kissinger, not me. So there's not just me who thinks we're in the foothills of a Cold War. This one is very different from the last Cold War, which many of your listeners would have lived through, because it comes at a time when the last one came at a time where there were no economic capital or even political links really between what became the Soviet Union and what became to call the West. So severing the two bits, bringing down that Iron Curtain, had a very, very limited economic and financial dislocation. creating an iron curtain, if we like, around China or wherever the Chinese influence may spread to, is going to create a huge economic and financial dislocation, given how integrated China is, clearly to the world trading regime, but also, let us not forget, to the world's financial regime. It's a country that may have capital controls and may restrict its own citizens' flow of capital out of that country, but there are significant, very, very significant foreign investments in China, in not so much the listed market, but in the world of foreign direct investment. So a Cold War has profound, profound economic implications, which I think initially are deflationary. Severing these links was going to create a financial crisis somewhere. Now, it may be Hong Kong, or it may be Singapore, or it may be France, who also lend a lot of money into Asia. But that dislocation is initially deflationary. However, in the very long term, I think it's genuinely inflationary if we get back into a Cold War. And we seek to source all the goods and products that currently flood from China, seeking to source them elsewhere. Adding the capacity to do that will take some time, and I think it's a little bit inflationary. Of course, in terms of my timing and your timing and everyone who's listening to this, I think the crucial thing is, can we have a Cold War with China keeping its currency stable against the US? And I think the answer is no. It seems to me inconceivable that you could be in that form of conflict, or let's just say face down, and decide to use the monetary policy of your enemy, using hopefully a Cold War enemy. It just seems highly, highly unlikely. So in that light, the recent trade agreement between America and China seems to be a good indication of something that really isn't meant to last. I can't see how any sovereign country, certainly a sovereign country as big and powerful as China, would agree to hold its exchange rate up, to overvalue its exchange rate. And they call that overvaluation based on the fact that its foreign exchange reserves are not rising. To agree to overvalue its exchange rate and allow American monetary policy to play such a major role in influencing Chinese monetary policy is not the move of a sovereign state. And therefore, I don't believe it's going to last. In fact, the concessions that China has made in part one of this trade deal make it very likely to me there won't be a part two. In fact, they make it even clearer that this is a Cold War. That might sound strange, but to concede such a major issue as currency and exchange rate policy at this time in the discussion suggests to me that this will not last. And therefore, it's much more like the Ribbentrop-Molotov deal of 1939 than it is like any permanent lasting trade deal leading to part two. Both sides know that this is not the time for them to make a move. They're not ready. Maybe they're not ready in terms of technology of where they have their chip production. Maybe they're not ready in terms of military, in terms of where they have their deterrence in forms of missiles. But for whatever reason, part one is a holding pattern in which we're racing into a Cold War. And that Cold War is taking place in capital movements, it's taking place in technology, it's taking place in intellectual property, and it's taking place in trade, and it's taking place militarily. And anybody who scans the newspapers can see that we're shifting on all five of those fronts. And when you shift on all five of those fronts, it's very hard to believe that there is a lasting trade deal to come. For investors, the crucial number one issue, I think, is the stability of the Chinese exchange rate. It won't last much longer. And a world with a flexible Chinese exchange rate is a very different world from the last 30 years. And then we have all the problems in assessing the long-term impacts of a Cold War well beyond that first initial move in the exchange rate, which, once again, initially is deflationary.
Russell, you are best known as a financial historian, and I want to tap into that knowledge for my final question, because some of the things that you've predicted in this interview, particularly the stage being set for the European Union in particular, but also other developed economies, to seriously consider capital controls, because a lot of the macro drivers that you're describing could potentially encourage large institutions to want to move a lot of their assets out of European markets into U.S. markets, and that creates a self-reinforcing vicious cycle of dollar appreciation and so forth. So there's a good reason to think that capital controls might be in the future. Meanwhile, you just told us that you see that we're now in the formative stages of a new Cold War with China. Well, certainly in the last Cold War, that resulted in the imposition of a lot of rules that would otherwise not have existed that control who's allowed to invest where in the world. So how different might the financial landscape be in the future than what we're used to as we get into this new regime where the European Union needs to be worried about these things and we have a Cold War developing?
Yeah, well, we do have a historical parallel, which is 1945 to, let's say, 1980, and probably up to 1989, realistically, when we talk about the end of the Cold War and also liberalization of capital controls in Europe, and kept them much longer than everywhere else. So I think we can all go back and look at that period of history as some guide to what to do, how to invest, and where to make money. Maybe I can just leave you with one idea what some of the great winners of that period of history in equities were: companies with very large fixed assets. Those companies were beneficiaries of higher inflation when interest rates stayed low. They were beneficiaries of that as long as they didn't have to reinvest a huge amount of the cash flow back into the fixed assets. Those were sustainable fixed assets without high reinvestment. Those are asset-heavy companies. We just had a 40-year bull market in asset-light companies. So it couldn't be more profound, this turnaround, not just in the reordering of returns in financial asset prices, but even within the equity market, the winners and the losers are likely to be very different in this new world. And I think anybody listening to this will begin to realize that this raises many more questions than answers, because it is such a profound change in what we've known really since the late 1970s. So unfortunately for most of us, it's back to the future.
Finally, Russell, as we close, I want to talk a little bit more about the ERIC website and what you offer there. Just to explain to our listeners, I sourced my questions for today's interview from one of your reports, Russell. It's called When Debt Matters, Where to Expect Credit Crises in the Next Recession. That's a 40-page report. It's only one of the many offerings on your website, and we only got to page 3 in the time that we had for today's interview. So it is a treasure trove of concise, very well-written institutional research. Tell us a little bit more about what's there and how our institutional audience can find out more about it.
Thanks, Eric. Well, anybody who's regulated can register for free on ERIC, and when they're free on ERIC, there is some free content. The free content that I produce for ERIC is every couple of weeks. I write an update on what's going on in the world. That's free to any regulated institutional investor. I am one of 145 research providers on ERIC, so there are other free contributions in there. Of course, we all have an economic incentive to be there, and that is there's also a subscription package of more detailed reports, such as the one you just mentioned, available to institutional investors. I'm afraid it has to be institutional investors. That's the nature of our platform. We're not regulated, so we can only match regulated sellers and regulated buyers. But I hope that if anybody is listening who's in a regulated financial advisor, is interested in some of the free content we have there, and also having a look at why there's independent investment opinion available. We're looking, I think, increasingly at an oligopoly of opinion forming in the marketplace, fewer and fewer providers. On ERIC, we've got 145. Virtually all of them work outside the confines of investment banks. And I think and I hope that that means they can provide more independent investment advice to all institutional investors.
And listeners, you'll find a sample of one of the free pieces that Russell has written linked in your research roundup email. For people who want to go deeper than just that one free sample and get access to all of these different writers' free work, as well as find out more about how to get on board with your subscription service, give us the website URL and how to contact you.
Okay, so we're www.eric.com, and you will find us. Easy way to do it. If you put my name and ERIC with a C into any search engine, you'll end up straight at the ERIC website.
So again, that's www.eric-c.com. We're going to have to leave it there. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, what a great interview with Russell. It was amazing to hear him talking about how the rules of the financial system are going to evolve and things like MMT are going to be dynamically changing things in the future. But what I really agreed with was the fact that he thinks more than likely that these changes are going to come because of crisis. And on a very short to intermediate time frame, we first have to have something in the system break before some of these more draconian policies start being implemented. What did you take away from the interview?
Well, Patrick, this one was a huge, huge eye-opener for me. And the reason is, for at least 5 years now, I have been absolutely positively convinced that this situation is all going to end in tears eventually. And what I mean by that is, look, we had this really big financial crisis in 2008. It was all about too much debt, and we've responded to it by creating more debt. And central banks are propping the system up by conjuring money supply out of thin air. And I've always thought this just has to lead to another credit crisis. And I've always thought that it would be credit driven and that that would eventually have contagion into the stock market and so forth. And I thought, okay, I don't know when it's going to happen, but at some point this is unsustainable. We're going to have another big credit and banking crisis in the United States. And boy, let's get ready to short those junk bonds and triple Bs. And I'm kind of making a mental plan for how I expect this to go when eventually the shit hits the fan and there's another credit crisis. What I really had never thought about until listening to this interview with Russell was the potential that that all happens almost in reverse. In other words, that there is a credit crisis, exactly as I predicted, as a result of all of this largesse that we've seen in central bank policy since the last crisis, but it starts outside the United States. That same phenomenon, Patrick, of the U.S. being the cleanest dirty shirt in the laundry pile means that what we get is this huge international capital flow into U.S. credits and into U.S. stock market, because it's the rest of the world that's having the credit and stock market crisis, and that ends up causing the opposite result in U.S. markets that I was previously anticipating. Now, I'm not saying I'm persuaded that that's how it's going to go down now, but that possibility had never really occurred to me until hearing this interview.
So, Eric, before we get to my chart book, I wanted to just quickly ask you, on what's your take on what's going on with this coronavirus and the impacts you think it's going to have on the market?
You know, what we tend to look for in markets is, okay, who's the guru, who's the expert, who knows more than we do? And I think in this case, you've just got to say, look, if you watched the WHO press conference today, you know as much as anybody does. The situation is, this could be horrifically bad like the bubonic plague, or it could be over by tomorrow and completely forgotten about. We just don't know yet. What the WHO told us today is there is not sufficient reason to start panicking yet. They contemplated the possibility of escalating this and declaring a global pandemic risk, and they decided against doing so. And they were very clear. They said, look, the situation inside of China right now is crisis level, no doubt about it. But as far as it being an international crisis, there's really no reason to come to that conclusion yet. And they were very specific, saying it could easily escalate to that, but we haven't yet had cause to do that. These things are very, very difficult to predict. There is the possibility that this whole thing is going to blow over. It's going to be certainly a big deal for China, but it could be contained to the point that there is no more real contagion risk to the rest of the world. Or this could be 10 times bigger than SARS and could be an absolute global pandemic. We just don't know yet, and I don't think anyone does. The best that we can do is to continue to stay tuned to the updates, and I'm sure WHO will have more press conferences like the one we had today to keep us informed. What I can tell you with absolute certainty, Patrick, is that our listeners can find a link in their Research Roundup email to your chart deck. Patrick, what a novel title you picked for this week's chart book, which is titled Charts.
Well, I didn't have any creativity left in me. No, just kidding. But with that said, let's dive into it. I really wanted to put on some really interesting levels on the S&P 500 that I think there's one particular level on the S&P on page 2 that is just worth watching. And so what I first have here is a little snapshot of the gamma profile of the S&P 500. That is a snapshot from spot gamma. In fact, anyone that wants to learn more about the gamma flip and that, I included a link in the Research Roundup to a great interview with Brent Kachuba from Spot Gamma talking and explaining this gamma flip. With that said, the level for the flip actually occurs somewhere around 32-35 according to these charts on the S&P. What's interesting about that kind of 32 35 to 32.50 level is there's a number of Fibonacci retracements and the ascending trend line all kind of converging at those same areas. And I'm sure there's a whole array of moving averages that all are within a stone's throw of that area. And this is an interesting level. It's not about predicting that that market is imminently going to break below that level. But the way I kind of look at it is that any sell-off that the S&P 500 has that actually stays at or above that level has a very good chance of being bought on dip and shoot the stock market right back up. And very similar to what we experienced during that early January sell-off that got down to the 3180 level, almost immediately got bought on dip. And so the way I kind of look at it is that so long as, if we had a quick 50 or 70 S&P point sell-off, it could be very rapidly bought on dip and shooting the market right back up. Where all of the danger zones are obviously where everything could flip would be a sell-off that just rips through that level. I mean, if we find ourselves down at 3200, it may really open the window for that sell-off to accelerate all the way back to those levels near 3,000 on the S&P. It's more like a 3,050 level, but that kind of a sell-off would all happen once these technical triggers all get hit. And so this is something that I'm really watching here in the next few days, or weeks, that is.
Okay, so to summarize, if we just look at this chart where it says gamma flip here, you can see there was a fair bit of consolidation and sideways tape action until you got through that gamma flip zone. The gamma flip took effect and it was off to the races from there. You're basically saying that could work in reverse. If we go back through that same gamma flip zone, it could accelerate the selling to the downside if we close below the blue line. Is that a reasonable summary?
That is, but just as a note, though, back in early January, when the S&P was trading around that 3250, the gamma flip zone actually was down around 3180. So it's like a trailing, it almost behaves like a trailing stop. It's actually been rolling behind the market. So actually, when the market was there back earlier January, the gamma level wasn't there. We were actually in the low volatility zone of the gamma at that moment.
Let's move on now to page 3, where you've got a chart of the euro-US dollar currency cross.
Right. So before we get to the euro, what I wanted to preface all of this is that one of the things that's been going on over the last 3-4 months has been everyone's been pumping into the reflation narrative. It's been an incredibly popular trade. And so the three kind of precipitating things that I watch that are core to the reflation trend are the trend of the dollar, trend of oil, and subsequently the trend of interest rates. And what we're seeing here with the breakdown of the euro back down below 111, I'm really watching the 110 level below because we've already broken the descending trend line. But I mean, if the euro starts cracking down in the next couple of weeks to 110 and then even takes a shot at breaking below that, that's going to be the first warning sign that reflation impulse may actually be running out of steam and completely reversing. And so this is just a level that I think is so important for our listeners to watch in the coming weeks.
And moving on to slide 4, you've got crude oil. What's the story here?
Well, I mean, you've already said these levels. I just wanted to kind of put it into that reflation storyline. And so we had this scenario where oil was doing very well and that entire story was working right up until the start of the year. And then since then, we've had a very rapid reversal in crude oil and not only breaking the upwards trend line, but doing some significant technical damage. I mean, the Fibonacci zones were all in that $57, $58 area. It ripped through it like a hot knife through butter. And so oil is starting to do some real damage to that storyline as well, right?
And I'll just add, Patrick, that as far as my own analysis, you know, this could be done. We could have seen the bottom today, or it could be that we're just going to get a little bounce and we're going straight back down to below $51. I don't know which yet, but it seems like it's one or the other. Either this was it or the next move that I see in terms of support is 50 spot 66. What do you think the factors are that are going to determine whether the reflation trade resumes or if we see a continued breakdown?
Right. Well, in general, the reflation story has it's probably the hottest trade out there, or at least over it was over the last couple months. And this is the interesting part for me. It's not about trying to predict that it is over, but these are the things that you want to watch to see whether or not everyone's exiting that trade and the narrative is changing. Because if you go back to 2019, there was a major flip in the middle of the year, right? In the first half of the year, deflationary forces and a monstrous collapse in interest rates and yields was the most dominant factor. And really the last 3, 4, 5 months has been this idea that that was overdone and yields are going higher and commodities are going higher and the dollar is going to be weak. This has been the storyline. And really that it looks like there's massive cracks in this argument now. And if this is reversing, that changes the entire landscape and may ultimately spill over to the S&P inevitably, right?
And let's move on to page 5, where you're showing U.S. 10-year Treasury yields.
Right. And so this is where I wanted to kind of touch on. I mean, this is quite an emotional topic in terms of whether there's a bond bull market or a bear market underway. And there's no shortage of bond bears out there. But the one thing I wanted to illustrate was, in spite of the fact that interest rates in 2019 basically went from north of 3% to 1.5%, a halving of the interest rates, even under the most basic technical premise, whether you're using, let's say, Dow theory or some Fibonacci levels or something like that, we should have seen a meaningful retracement in bond yields that should have sent us towards, you know, 2.25 to 2.50 on the yield, just as a natural reaction from that monstrous move. And when you really kind of step back and look at how much yields have been able to pick up off of those lows, it's pretty pathetic. I mean, the bond bears have not been able to get any traction whatsoever, and it really does look like it's rolling over. Now, I don't want to officially say that the reflation story is dead, but this is one of the most interesting things to watch in the coming weeks. If we see yields cracking below 170, we may have the entire landscape shift in the markets, and I think it's one of the most important things to watch.
And certainly it was something that Russell's comments in today's interview suggested, that he thinks we're headed lower in yield. Patrick, I want to take this a step farther. You've already said 170 is a key level. Let's suppose that we get the next signal after that. I'm guessing it would be a new low below the August lows, which is just below 1.50. At that point, you'd be looking after that great big 2018 and 2019 drop at a bounce that didn't even hit really any of the key Fib levels. What would that tell you? Would that just be that much more bearish in terms of yield and therefore bullish in terms of bond price? Or what would the interpretation be if that signal were to occur?
Well, you know what? Interest rates are so much more than just technical analysis. All I know is that the price action on bonds has been, I would argue, is still very bullish. And these yields just are incredibly weak. And I still think there's plenty of room for another leg in the bond market. I mean, if we see a deterioration below 170, it's almost in the cards to go retest all those major lows that we had along 140. And if we break 140, I don't see how we don't head down to 1% yield on the 10-year. Now, that's getting ahead of ourselves. Let's not make that as a prediction. Let's first see whether this is set in motion. But you can hand me a handful of nails to put a coffin in the reflation trade if we break that level.
And finally, Patrick, moving on to slide 6 in the deck, it's almost February. And like all good Canadians, you are going to celebrate February by getting the hell out of Canada. What's going on in Orlando, February 6th through 8th, that gives you an excuse to hop out of town?
I'm going to be down in Florida at the Orlando Money Show. It's being held February 6th to 8th. It's the biggest one of their shows. And I'm going to be speaking there on both February 7th and 8th with presentations I've done in the past that some of our members or listeners may have heard. But I'm going to be talking about straddles, and I'm also going to be talking about the commodity cycles. So anyone that can make it out to the Orlando Money Show, make sure you say hello to me. Come see the sessions. And at the end of the show, a number of the other panelists and speakers at that show are going to meet up with me for some drinks on Saturday, and all of our listeners are welcome to join us for a pint. So hopefully we'll see many of our listeners out there.
Fantastic. And again, that's February 6th through 8th at the Omni Resort at Champions Gate in Orlando. This episode was made possible by TopTradersUnplugged.com. Remember to get the ultimate guide to the best investing books ever written at TopTradersUnplugged.com/macro guide. For information on sponsoring Macro Voices, please visit macrovoices.com/sponsor info. And of course, if you don't have a research roundup email, it means you haven't registered yet for your free account. So be sure and do so. You can do it at macrovoices.com. Won't cost you anything, only takes a few minutes. The benefit to you is you'll receive our research roundup email, which provides links to all of the best free content that we can find on the internet each week, including supporting materials for our own feature interviews. Patrick, tell them what they can expect to find in this week's research roundup.
Well, this week you're going to find the transcript for that great interview with Russell, as well as a link to the chart book we discussed, including the link to that interview with Brent Kachuba from Spot Gamma that we mentioned earlier as well. There's also an interesting link to a Ray Dalio interview in Davos, as well as a great interview with Paul Tudor Jones. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's research roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend and myself at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com. The internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.